Accession number 10600, reel 15.
Mr. John Wainwright, reel 15. After your college, you qualified at Wigan Mining College. What happened then?
Well, I qualified, got the diploma of the Mining College, and during the course of the college, I'd taken the colliery manager certificate, which had nothing to do with the course, really. I mean, that was a statutory qualification arranged by the mines department. But anyway, I got the diploma, first class diploma of the college, and then I went back to Worsley Mains Colliery as a junior official, and was there for several months. And in the meantime, I was applying for a post as a colliery manager, because I got the statutory qualification, and I thought I got all the other qualifications for the job too. And so eventually I was appointed as manager of the Leyland Green Colliery of the Winstanley Collieries Limited.
In Leyland Green?
Leyland Green Colliery, owned by the Winstanley Collieries Limited.
What was your role as colliery manager? What were you?
Well,
duties?
I mean, the duties of a colliery manager are laid down by the Act of Parliament. It was under that time it was the Coal Mines Act of 1911, and the duties of general supervision and safety of the mine were laid down in various regulations of that Act. It would take too long to, but you were in charge of all operations. You were in charge of the production. You were in charge of the safety and of the mine. In fact, I mean, everything that happened at the mine, the ultimate responsibility in law was on the manager.
And how did you go about it? How did you go about running the mine?
Well, you just went about running the mine like as the manager does. I mean, you got your own office at the mine there. You had the various under officials at the mine, and you used to have daily consultations with the underground officials of the mine. You had to countersign all statutory reports, and then during the daytime we'd make inspections of the various seams. At Winstanley Colliery we had different seams at different horizons, different levels below ground. We had the Oral 4 feet, the Oral 5 feet, later on the Yard Mine, the Oral Yard Mine, Winstanley 5 feet, and the King Mine. And these were all, had to be inspected. That was one of the duties of the manager, to inspect his workings from time to time. So it was a very busy time.
And then after
the end of the shift there, you'd have a consultation with the under manager, and if necessary, the deputies of the various districts there.
How did you react to the two strikes at the time? One was when you were at the college, the other was in 26. How did you feel about the strikes? Did you have sympathy for the miners, or...?
Well, the job of the manager was to carry on under the various regulations. I mean, the wages that were paid, I mean, they were laid down by agreements with the various unions. In general, wages were very, very low. But what wages could be paid depended on the amount that could be got for the fuel, for the product. Prices were very, very low, and there was a lot of competition between one district and another, and this all tended to keep the prices down, which necessarily meant the wages were kept down, otherwise the mines couldn't carry on. There was general unrest in the industry, and it was a very difficult time.
Were you at Leyland Green during the 26?
I was at Leyland Green the whole time of the 1926 strike.
So how did you cope?
Well, our main job was to see that the mine was safe there. There were one or two officials who were definitely not on strike. Some of them were on strike. But they had to have inspection of the underground workings to see that they were kept safe, free from gas, and if any there were any falls, they had to be attended to. Apart from that, I mean, we had a lot of stock, we had stocks of coal on the ground, and which were sold during the strike, which helped to keep to pay for the men that you had on maintenance and so forth. So there was a very busy time during the strike.
How did you get on with the miners on strike? Would you see them? Would they picket or?
Well, there was quite a bit of trouble in the Wigan district. People used to go by what we call the mobs, going about from one colliery to another, to make sure that there weren't any what they called blacklegs working at the mine too. But all mines, they were to some extent they were guarded by the police. I know at Winstonley Colliery, we had 4 or 5 policemen there who were keeping in touch with the colliery, and also along the lines that we had railway lines leading down to the various railways. So we had this support from the police. We did get a message one day that the mob was coming from Pemberton towards Winstonley, but that was a false alarm. So generally speaking, we had practically no trouble at all. Then.
Did you employ any what they call blackleg labour?
Towards the end of the war, remember that strike went on for nearly 6 months there. And during the strike, we'd had to abandon some of the lower seams, which meant that they became waterlogged.
What do you mean abandoned? You couldn't run the pumps then, or
we couldn't run the. We had to. The pumps were stopped, and where the water was gradually working up. We decided to abandon the bottom seam, so we wanted to open a seam higher up in the shaft there, and also wanted to put a pump in. So I went round with one of the two officials who were working, see if anybody would help us on this, and we got a team to help on this job. I mean, it was really to their own interest there, because if the water had risen much further than it did, another mine would have been flooded out. So we did have, but we had a hut on the surface for the men who were working, because I suppose there'd be a certain amount of feeling amongst all the cronies, you know, about working, whether they thought it was necessary or not. So most of the men decided they would stay at the colliery. So we had a hut fixed up with beds for them, and we fed them, and so on.
When they did go back, what was the mood of the men? Did it cause trouble in the colliery?
No. I mean, the men had 6 months of it, and they were glad to get back to work, I suppose, but they weren't, and they decided they'd lost the battle, and that was it. And they just got to make the best of it.
There were no hard feelings then on either side.
Well, there was no hard feelings between the management and the men. I mean, I never had any trouble with the men. We were on one side and they were on the other. They knew that the management had got to do their job. You know, the manager got to do his job, and they were doing their job too.
Was there any action taken against the ringleaders, so to speak, the officials, the union officials?
No, we know trouble at all there. I mean, as a matter of fact, the local union representative at Winstonley Colliery, just been dead a long, long time now, so it doesn't matter if I give his name. I mean, it was Seth Martlew, and he certainly was a great help in getting some men to help to get these places ready and get this pump fixed up in the shaft and so on.
How long were you at Leyland Green, Winstanley?
We were at about, well, it was about 6 months. The strike lasted 6 months.
No, I mean after the strike. How long did you stay there?
Well, then the next year, that was the end of 1917 when the 27 when the strike ended. And about 12 months afterwards, been difficulties about prices and trade and so forth, and it was decided to close the colliery down. couriers were closing down, not all over the place. So we were the first to close down of our conglomeration of companies. Worsley Mains closed down, Ellerbeck closed down, and sort of I was offered a job at Ellerbeck and later on at Crosslands in South Wales. That was the South Wales part of the concern, but I decided not to, that it was too much to take up my roots there with a young family and newly married. So I decided to look round and started a small coal owner.
What gave you that idea? Was that a common thing to happen, or...?
Well, there always have been small mines. I mean, in the... Because when it came to nationalisation, as a matter of interest, there were 450 small mines, all in Great Britain, who got licences to work coal by licence. So there always have been small mines, small, medium and large mines.
How did you go about setting it up? Because that's quite interesting.
Well, the small mines generally were organised in their own districts, but not nationally.
How did you go about setting up your own mine? I mean, because it was at Billinge, wasn't it?
Just by local knowledge and by looking at the geological maps and then comparing the workings with the old workings, lower workings at the Winstanley Colliery. We knew where to look generally, and we got some boring tackle, and we proved the seam at certain points, and then decided from that to go forward. So we applied for a lease. It was a lease that was before nationalising. So we applied for a lease to the local landlord, Winstanley Hall, the Squire Banks of Winstanley Hall, and we got a 21-year lease, I think it was, which was later extended, I mean, to work a certain area of coal. So we went on by a drift mine, actually. It was a drift mine, and then we had a vertical mine for the return way for ventilation purposes. Not very, very deep. And the ventilation plant on the top of this temporary shaft.
How many men did you employ?
Well, by law, I mean... By licence, we were limited to... later on, we were limited to 30 men. But under the Mines Act, a small mine was one where less than 20, or not more than 30 men, were employed underground. So we tried to keep within that definition. Because there were certain aspects which were to the advantage of the small owner regard to the regulations. Well, in some respects, they were not quite as onerous as they were for the large men. I don't mean they weren't as safe, but I mean there were allowances made for the size of the mine and so forth. But there were certain aspects. Another point, which didn't apply to us anyway, that for a small mine, it wasn't necessary to have a first-class certificate of manager. You could have a second-class and so on. But anyway, that didn't matter to us because, I mean, I got a first-class certificate. So I carried on as manager and managing director of the concern. So we started as a drift mine and went down at an angle because the inclination of the seam was dipping down, inclining towards Wigan at about 1-inch 6. So they were getting gradually more and more cover. So by the time we were 700 or 800 yards down, I mean, there was probably 100 or 120 yards off cover above us. So, in effect, it was equivalent to a deep mine.
How much coal would you get?
Well, we were limited, as I say, by manpower. So, I mean, roughly about 12,000 tonnes a year, about 1,000 tonnes a month, something like that. And that was a reasonable sort of figure for a small mine. Some had much.
How would you
left.
Get it away from the mine?
Well, we got it away by lorry. Eventually, we bought our own lorries, and we used to send the around domestic coal by lorry out and and supply the customers direct.
So you were a coal merchant as well?
We dealt with our own coal, and then we supplied coal to the electricity works. We had our electricity, gas works. And so on.
Is that how you were able to make... Because the background was of coal mines closing, and I was wondering how you made the profit, you know.
Well, the selling price of coal in those days in Lancashire was about, you hardly believe this, but it was about 14 shillings per tonne. So, I mean, to make a mine pay, you were met with this wages cost of something like 40, I mean, wages cost of 11 or 12 shillings a tonne. And then there were explosives and timber and various other costs. So you had to keep your costs down so that you could make a profit. If your costs exceeded, well, 14 or 15 shillings a tonne, you were in the black, you're in the red rather.
Would you try and keep the labour costs down or what? Because they're the main.
Well, you had to be efficient. The point was the men were on piecework, you see, so there was an incentive for them to get more wages themselves there. So I mean, there was a definite minimum wage, but if you had piece rates, I mean, they could get more than the minimum rates.
Were they unionised?
Oh yes, they were all members of the union there. They were all union men anyway. They all joined the unions.
Just another. How did you get the initial capital? Because it's quite an expensive undertaking. As you said, the timber, the explosives.
Well, I said there were four of us there, and we just dipped into our pockets and got a few £100 each and put it into the kitty, and to see how we started. We started off with less than £1,000 anyway, and then we found out after we'd been going a few months we wanted more capital. And then we had to sort of dip in again and provide more capital. And then eventually it became profitable. You supply the profits back again. So we built up the capital that way. Eventually formed a limited company, would you see.
How did the Second World War affect the small colliery? We both with your men going off to war and the trade you were doing, did you have to produce more, or were you put under direction? How did it affect you?
Well, it became difficult when generally speaking, miners were an exempt trade, you know. I mean, it wasn't necessary. Some men volunteered, you know, they could be accepted, but it was an exempt trade. So I mean, you probably didn't have the same difficulty in manpower that some of the other industries had. We never short of men during the war.
Did it affect your working though, the war?
Big one.
Did it affect the your production methods or your?
Well,
range?
There were all sorts of regulations about prices and so forth, and you had to live with these things. And we just carried on during the wartime and kept our noses clean and just made a reasonable profit.
So it didn't affect you too much, the war.
Well, no. I mean, we kept on going, and we made a slight. We kept on the right side during the wartime. There,
it reduced your profits, but
we kept going. There, we didn't need any help from anybody. So, I mean, there was a ready market. I mean, there was no question you could sell all the coal that was produced there. So you hadn't any stocking problems and capital lying on the ground doing nothing. So, I mean, there was a ready sale for coal. So, generally speaking, the sales were all right. But in the meantime, in the North West, under the 1930 Act of Parliament, central selling schemes could be formulated in any district who desired if they agreed to it. And in Lancashire, there were the Lancashire Associated Collieries, and all the collieries, large and small, in the Lancashire coalfield, joined this central selling scheme. So the selling of the scheme was done through the Associated Collieries, who had areas, Wigan area, Manchester area, St Helens, and North Lancashire, and they were selling offices and stuff, and they actually arranged the disposals from each colliery. So there was no difficulty in getting rid of those. And the tendency was that they, as a central organisation like that, they could probably get rather better prices for the fuel than we as individuals could. So that central scheme was quite a good thing for the small mines anyway. So we had no difficulty in getting rid of our sales, and there was someone there to look after the selling prices, and wages increased, but they only increased to the same extent that the selling prices. There were sort of war wages and awards for this, that and the other during the war. But I mean, that sort of more or less balanced by the increased wages that were paid.
How did the nationalisation affect you? Because you carried on, I know.
Well, nationalisation didn't come on until 1946, and it was after the general election of 1945 that it was obvious then that nationalisation was coming. By the way, I ought to mention that the small owners in the various districts had their own local organisations that looked after the interests of the small owners as against the big owners, and so that they had their representation on the Lancashire Executive, on the Lancashire Associated Collieries.
What was the organisation called?
It was the Lancashire Associated Collieries, LAC, isn't it?
No, the small.
I was the Central Lancashire Coal Owners Association Limited. So that was formed about 1924, actually, long before the war. So that was looking after the interests of small owners long before nationalisation. So that when nationalisation came, these local associations who had been working on a local basis, there was no national organisation. Someone took the initiative to call a meeting in in York, as a matter of fact, the station hotel in York, and inviting representatives of all the various coal fields to send representatives, and to cut a long story short, from that a federation of small mines was formed, not under that name at the time. I think it was the National Federation of Unassociated Mines or something, and soon after the formation of that, I was appointed chairman. We had a committee formed from that association, and we met various ministers of the government, and we made our representations. We tried to keep outside nationalisation, asked if small mines could be exempted. But
why
nothing.
Did you want that? Could you just explain it?
Well, because we didn't want to be part of a national nationalised undertaking. We thought we could carry on quite well as individuals, and that the amount of the 2 or 3 million tons of coal that we were getting wouldn't affect the national interest in any shape or form, and that we could make reasonable profits without all being tied to the coal board.
And that was accepted by the government?
Well, it was accepted to that extent that eventually they agreed to grant licences to any mine who thought they were entitled to one, who came within the regulator. One of the conditions of the licence was that the underground people should be kept under 30, that not more than 30 men could be employed. You could have as many men on the surface as you wanted, but then on number. But there were even exceptions to that. They could be grabbed under special circumstances, more than 30 could be employed, and that in effect took place, because I was connected later on during the nationalisation period with one of the mines. I became consultant there, and we had one licence, but we had two seams there, and we were granted the 30 men for each seam, and then because of the circumstances further. So, I mean, for that one small mine, as it was, we had a deep shaft and a drift. They gave us a composite licence, and we'd probably 70 or 80 men employed underground. But they were limited to those two seams. In effect, we had two licences.
What about your own mine, your own mine? How long did that carry on working after nationalisation?
Well, we kept on until the early 50s. But in the meantime, the Opencast had started operations in Lancashire. They'd started off first, I think it was Rainford, a few miles away from Billings, from our Leyland Green Colliery. And gradually they came towards this Billings area, where Billings and Winston, the area. And eventually there was Opencast operations going on right above our workings. Our men were working there under yards, underneath, deep under the surface there. And there were the Opencast operations going on there with tremendous blasting operations, water problems and so forth. And we'd untold difficulties, water problems, falls of earth, falls of ground in the airways and so forth. I mean, I've had an ever-expanding file of correspondence with the regional commissioner for the Northwest, who was in charge of coal production, trying to get to do something about this. He promised all sorts of things, that they would limit the amount of explosive, limit the times of firing us off. But it got to the stage there that everybody was on edge there, because whereas our shot firing down the mine, probably we would have a few ounces of explosive for a shot down the mine. They were using hundreds of pounds of explosives, and there was this noise and this blasting that was going on there, and then you had little trickles of rock falling down when they were going on. That everybody got on edge.
Was anyone hurt?
And we never had anybody hurt, but by this time our work were getting fairly extensive, and the furthest point from our drift or the return away shot was getting on probably getting nearly a mile. Yes, so 1,500 yards. And it was a long way away and up tunnels and a long drift, you know. And so I made representations to the regional commission that we should have to close the mine down unless something was done about it. So eventually the ministry agreed to drive what was called an escape drift from the surface to these workings at this extremity. So the bulk of our men are working around, in the case of any emergency, they were quite near to get to the surface. But even after that, it got to the stage, and I finished up with under the dock, I got ulcers and so forth. Everybody was on edge, and eventually we decided to call it a day, and we gave notice to terminate our lives. We had to give 6 months' notice, I think it was, whatever it may be, 3 months, but we gave the statutory notice, and the mine was closed down.
Did you stay in mining?
Stayed in mining, yes, because I went temporarily as a manager to one of the largest small mines in the country, Windy Harbour Colliery, which is only about a mile from our own drift mine in Winstonley. And I was there then as mining engineer and consultant until they closed down in 1976.
And that's when you retired, is it?
That's when I retired from active mining, the actual mining, but I still, in the meantime, I was chairman of the Federation of Small Mines of Great Britain, and still the chairman, did all the negotiating with the National Coal Board and the Ministry and so forth. So I kept on, and even after the Windy Harbour closed down, I kept on in a temporary capacity, supposed to be, in with the office in Wigan for the Federation until 2.5 years ago.
How did you, looking back, how do you think the First World War affected you mentally and physically?
Well, it affected me physically. During the war, this dysentery seemed to bother me for a long, long time. For years and years, I always seemed to have some tummy trouble. In fact, I still have tummy trouble now, which I think is due to the dysentery. I've got to destroy the linings of the tummy and all the rest of it. and I'm still taking medicine for stomach disorders even now. I could carry on, but I find that I've got to take this medicine.
And mentally, how did it affect?
Pardon?
And mentally?
And I've still got a bit of this arthritis. I mean, my left knee has always bothered me right from the First World War. Because I think I mentioned...